This morning's reading is from Psalm 139, 1 to 24, which is the whole psalm. Thanks, David. You have searched me, Lord, and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. Before word is on my tongue, you, Lord, know it completely. You hem me in behind and before, and you lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me, your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me and the light become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like day, for darkness is as light to you. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. How precious to me are your thoughts, God. How vast is the sum of them. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. When I awake, I am still with you. If only you, God, would slay the wicked. Away from me, you who are bloodthirsty. They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. Do I not hate those who hate you, Lord, and abhor those who are in rebellion against you? I have nothing but hatred for them. I count them my enemies. Search me, God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting.
Nearly ready. I often do things wrong, you know. You might find that hard to believe, but it's true. And if I've done something wrong and, you know, somebody points that out to me, that's fine. But I really do object when I get blamed for choosing the reading, but Martin has to read all 20 verses. When I have nothing to do with it. It's Carol he should blame because she sent it to me. And I have to be honest and say, when I learnt that I was asked to preach on Psalm 139, I was really pleased because it's such an amazing, wonderful, rich psalm. A psalm I've read many, many times and valued many, many times. But then I had a struggle, because in addition to the psalm, she told me what the theme was, and the theme was hope. And I thought, what on earth has this psalm got to do with hope? If you've got the answer, you can tell me, and then I'll try and preach on it. No, but it was a puzzle to me. Why pick that theme? What one commentator said, that the delicate motif of this psalm is friendship with God. Now, if she'd sent that to me, I could have worked on that really, really well, and you'd have had a great sermon this morning. But you won't get a great sermon because that's not what she said. She said, the theme is hope. And of course, there are many psalms in the Bible where if I was going to preach on hope, I would have chosen one of those. I mean, there's Psalm 42 and 43, which keep saying, put your hope in God, for I will yet praise him, my Saviour and my God. That, all the way through, that's what it was saying, and that would have made sense. Or there's Psalm 131. It's only short, Martin, so don't worry too much. My heart is not proud, O Lord. My eyes are not haughty. I do not concern myself with great matters or things too wonderful for me. I've stilled and quietened my soul like a weaned child with its mother. O Israel, put your hope in the Lord, both now and forever. What a great psalm about hope. But no, I get landed with Psalm 139 and hope. What on earth am I going to do with this, I ask myself. Some of you may know, but probably not everybody knows, that I'm a chaplain to two police stations in Leicestershire. One of them is Braunston, where I used to be, and one of them is Hinckley, where I used to be before that. So I'm chaplain to the police station here. And with that role, sometimes I get the privilege of speaking to the inspector, who's kind of the boss. Sometimes he's very busy, often he's not there because he's got a lot of other things to do. But on this occasion, soon after I was kind of starting to get all worked up about how I was going to preach on hope and Psalm 139, he sort of called me into his office. He even said, would you like a coffee? You know, they're normally too busy for that. I said, no, thank you. Just a great privilege to talk to him. Now, this man has seen a lot of the world. He was in the armed forces in Afghanistan, supporting people who were dealing with all those unexploded devices. He's seen a lot. But he was very troubled when he called me into his office. I hadn't done anything wrong, Martin. And he said he'd been reflecting on changes to society and the impact on policing. And he'd also been listening to a headmaster from a senior school, probably because one of his children goes there, describing how things have changed in the last two decades and how much more difficult it is to run a school. And the inspector was saying how much more difficult it is to keep the community safe. He was saying, 20 years ago, or even less, the people got into trouble when they were 18 or 19. He said, now it's 14 or 15. Things are getting so much worse, so difficult. And he was running through his mind some of the factors that might contribute to this growth in juvenile crime. He was saying, you know, some of these children feel so excluded from society. Some of them have very difficult, unstable home backgrounds. Some of them have been kicked out of school. Some of them spend most of their time, when they're not doing things they shouldn't, on computer games, learning how you can be violent and how it's okay to destroy people. He said, it's getting really, really difficult. And two or three days later, a lady who's about 35, maybe older, I'm not very good at guessing ladies' ages, she came in with her mother in a wheelchair to the coffee morning we have at the church where I'm involved at the moment. And she was just talking about things, and she started talking about her son and her son's friend. Now, this son's friend is 14. He's been accused of rape. And she was saying to us, this coffee gathering, in a way, you know, he's a nice lad. He comes round to our house. He's quite childish because he'll sit there quietly and he'll be sucking his thumb at 14. But she says, I know what his home life is like. He's got no father. His mother sits there rolling weed and smoking it and showing him how to do the same. Because of the environment of that home, he has to behave in a kind of adult, male, aggressive way. It's so difficult. It doesn't stand a chance. And here he is at 14. In a sense, he's already destroyed his life by his misdemeanors with people of the opposite sex. And listening to those two conversations helped me to see why this psalm is about hope. You see, there was, for these people who are in trouble, causing distress to the inspector or to somebody else, there's nobody that's probing their life. And so they have no hope. There's nobody who is a consistent, caring presence. And so they have no hope. There is no one who is really offering them deep, committed parenting. And so they have no real hope. And they don't have any purpose. And so they spend their lives causing trouble, creating distress, and in the process, destroying themselves and the people around them. And that's why this psalm is really a psalm of hope. You see, it says, O Lord, you have searched me, and you know me. Now, if you lost your phone and you knew somebody had found it and they managed to get around your password so they could read all the texts you've written in the last 3 months, all your WhatsApp messages, they could see all the videos you've watched, break into your Instagram account, check up what you've been doing on TikTok. I hope you're impressed by the fact I know all that. Would you sit at home comfortably? Or might you start to think, what did I say? What have I watched? This psalm says, O Lord, you have searched me and you know me. That ought to be a scary thing. And in some ways it is. But it's actually a profoundly reassuring thing. Because even though God can see every thought, know everything we've seen, understand every feeling we've ever had, He is still there for us. And people, young or old, need to know there is somebody who, to whom they matter so much that they will explore our lives. They will keep a handle on us. They will check out what we've been up to. Not because they want to destroy us, but because they love us and want to protect us from ourselves. And that's God. O Lord, you have searched me and you know me. And out of that concern comes something else. Because through that person keeping a loving but penetrating concern for us, we develop what we might call a moral compass. That's something that these young people don't have. They don't know right from wrong. They only know what suits them at the moment. And that's how I understand the words which kind of interrupt everything else, where the psalmist says, "If only you would slay the wicked, O God, away from me, you bloodthirsty men. They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. Do not I hate those who hate you, O Lord." But you see, it's because he knows there is a standard. And that standard is God. He knows there is right and there is wrong. And so he has, or she has even, this moral compass to direct them through their life. If nobody loves us enough to probe us, we end up without hope. But if somebody does, there is the seed of hope beginning in our lives. But this psalm tells us not only about there being a probing presence, it tells us there is this presence. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? Now, in the book of Job, similar words like that expresses frustration. He wants to get away from this God who's tormenting him, he thinks. It isn't the case, but that's what he thinks. But here the psalmist delights in the fact that he cannot escape from the presence of God. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? And that presence provides him and provides us with a sense of consistency. There is someone around us who is always there for us. No matter where we are, he's there. It isn't like we can go to the football match, or perhaps today, the test match, and think, I can shout whatever abuse I like at the Australians. Or maybe the English, if you are Australian. It isn't that I can think, there's nobody here that knows me, I can do whatever I like, let me get on with it. Because there is someone there. There is a presence from which we cannot escape. And that's what is this one of the things which makes this psalm so amazing, you see, because it isn't that the psalmist has a kind of petty, nationalistic sense of God. He's saying, no matter how brilliant your latest telescope is that can penetrate 13.2 billion years back and see what happened at the beginning of time, God was there. If I go to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn or settle on the far side of the sea, you're there. Lord, your presence fills the universe. And that's not a frightening thing for me. It's so reassuring that I cannot fall out of your loving arms. And people who have that sense of consistency can have hope. But it's because God offers him companionship that he's not frightened. He's discovered that this God who fills and penetrates the universe and everything there is and beyond it cares for him. Now, Jonah thought that if he went to the far side of the ocean, he could get away from God. But he had to discover he couldn't. This psalmist knows and is thankful that there is no escape from the love of this great God. Where can I go from your spirit? And because he knows there is always this presence, no matter what happens to him, no matter who attacks him, no matter how he fails, he can have hope. But then there's this business of parenting. So many of these young people who have no hope have no parenting. There are all these ancestor programs on television, aren't there? And there's recently been a series in long lost families of people who were foundlings, who were left in the telephone kiosk or at a hospital step or somewhere like that. They've got no idea who their biological parents are. In this series, all of them seem to have been extremely fortunate in that they were received into great foster homes that adopted them. They were brought up with love and had everything they could want. But there's something gnaws away at people when they don't know who their biological parents are. They feel there's something missing. There's an emptiness there. They want to know who their own flesh and blood are. You created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. Right from conception, the psalmist said, you have been concerned for me. Right at the very, very moment of my beginning, you were watching over me. There is no room for this psalmist for that sense of, I'm not sure where I come from, I'm not sure where I belong, because I don't know who my parents are. Even more profound than that, he knows, or she knows, that God was involved in her birth, or in his birth. You created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. I wasn't an accident. I was in your plan and your purpose. And so many of these people, these young people, without hope, who get into such terrible things and cause many other people awful distress, they don't really have a sense of who their parents were. Because either they're not there, or as in the case of that young man I introduced you to at the beginning, half the time their mother's not with it anyway, out of her mind on drugs. Right from conception. And because of that, he knows that God is utterly, utterly committed to him. Nothing can break the bond between God, his Father, and his own life. God is deeply involved and intimately aware of who we are. And because we have parents, because we have God as our Father, as we said in the Lord's Prayer, our Father, because of this, we can have hope. You created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place. And ultimately, for these young people, they have no purpose. Their lives are just chaotic. There is no order. They can't make sense of the stars in the sky. They have no meaning. Nothing has meaning. And so they do what impulse drives them to, or what will get them most kudos from their peer group. That's what they do. But for the psalmist, here's the truth. All the days ordained for me were written in your book. Suppose you went into a second-hand bookshop because you were going on holiday, and you went through the shelves and you thought, oh, that novel might be interesting. And you take it off hopefully you remember to pay for it. You go off on holiday and you start to read this book. And as you start to read this book, you're flabbergasted. Because the book is about you. What a surprise that would be. And as you read it, you think, wow, I'd forgotten that, but the author knew about that. What an amazing book. I'm not sure I want to get to the end because I don't know what's going to happen to me at the end. So I'll perhaps stop now. But imagine that's what's happened, because that's what the psalmist says. God, you've written the story of my life. That does not mean that we have no freedom. It does not mean that we're not involved in developing the plot and our character and the people that we meet. It does not mean everything that takes place was preordained. It means that God is involved in writing the story of our lives. He's constantly trying to move us into a good place that will be beneficial for us. He's watching over us. An author, you know, can sometimes give you 3 or 4 different endings because they're in a supreme position. And so if you intervened and said, I'm going to help you write this book, and you said, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to Mallorca for my holiday. I'm going to go to Bournemouth. Not sure why, but, you know, arbitrary things happen, don't they? The author can still steer it back. And that's what God is doing. That's what this psalmist has the conviction, that God is at work in his life, watching over him, ensuring that the story works its way through and that the right people come along at the right time to guide, to protect, to bless. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. And book of Proverbs says, in all your ways acknowledge him, and he will direct your path. And if we get it wrong and we acknowledge him, he'll direct our path back. Because God has an interest, as an author has an interest in the characters and the plot, so God has an interest in our lives. There's a sort of coordination going on. Our lives are not aimless. We're not just stardust floating around the universe. We fit together. We have a core purpose, a central identity that God is working to create for us. It's a marvelous thing. And as Paul says in his letter to the Ephesians, we are to walk in the good things, the good works that God has prepared beforehand for us. Our life is a partnership with God. And so we are not people without a purpose, and so we are not people without hope. In 1890, a fairly young man published a poem called The Hound of Heaven. You may have heard about it. It's quite a long poem, but let me read a few verses from it, or a little bit from it. I fled him down the arches of the years. I fled him down the labyrinthine ways of my own mind. And in the mist of tears, I hid from him, and under running laughter. Up vistaed hopes I sped and shot, precipitated, adown titanic glooms of chasmed fear. From those strong feet that followed after, but with unhurrying chase, an unperturbed pace, deliberate speed, majestic instancy they beat, and a voice beat more instant than the feet. I'd heard those words many times. I've probably quoted them in a sermon before, but it was only preparing for this that I discovered something about the background. The poem's known as The Hound of Heaven. It was written by a man called Francis Thompson, and he had quite a good youth. He was brought up in a religious home, caring parents, but he became a fugitive from God. He started off studying for the priesthood. They couldn't really be bothered with that. I can understand that. So then he thought, I'll have a go at medicine. He had a go at medicine, and he didn't really work hard enough, so he was thrown out of that. And from there, he turned to drugs. Yeah, they were available in the 19th century too. He lost himself in London. He'd pick up odd jobs, blacking boots, selling matches, holding horses, as you do, and anything so that he could raise a little bit of cash to get his next fix. But perhaps because of the drugs, I don't know, the one thing he still did was scribble some poems. And he eventually sent a few of his poems to a man called Wilfrid Meynell, who was an editor and a publisher. And this person recognized some of his talent. And he, together with his wife, went to search for this young man. This is what they found. No such figure had been looked for, more ragged and unkempt than the average beggar, with no shirt beneath his coat and bare feet in broken shoes. He wasn't in a great state, was he? This young man, he had no hope. He got lost. But he came to realize that there was something more powerful, deeper, more reliable, more trustworthy, more hopeful than he dared to believe. He discovered there was a God who would probe his life. A God who could provide him with the parenting that he needed, calling him back constantly to the person he should be. Someone who could take his empty, useless, purposeless life and give it meaning. Because he found that he was being pursued relentlessly, unavoidably, by a God who loved him. And so he had hope. The psalmist says, "Lead me in the way everlasting." And that's what God offers us. Not just hope for now, but hope for eternity. And he invites us, indeed he calls us, to share that hope with a lost generation. And the lost generation is not just those young people of 14 or 15 who are wasting their lives and destroying others in the process. That lost generation could be our children, our cousins, our brothers and sisters. Because without a God who embraces us with an embrace that cannot be broken wherever we go and whatever we do, we can end up without hope, without a real hope, a hope that will stand the test of time, a hope that will endure through the travesties that life throws at us. It's this God who gives us hope. And it's this hope that people all around us need so that they can discover the truth of Jesus, that I am the true and living way. And so I commend this psalm to you. Yes, a psalm of God's delightful companionship, but a psalm that, if we probe it a little, tells us that he is the source of our hope too.